Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 268, titled Americans Thought They Were Free. This is being recorded on January 7th of the year 2001. We're going to continue with analysis of the, quote, election, unquote, that was concluded in December of the year 2000. We've been talking about, among other things, a comparison of George II's, that's George W. Bush's, proposed governing style in which he sees himself as the chairman of the board of a corporation with Mussolini's corporate state. We've been talking about analysis from the foreign press of this as a right-wing coup, and we've also been talking about links between the anti-Castro Cuban milieu linked with the Bush faction of the CIA and the mob and pressure that was generated in Miami-Dade and that forced to a certain extent the halting of the recounting of the ballots. As noted in the first program, Gore was 140 votes ahead when the unofficial counting stopped for Christmas, and the Miami Herald projects Gore as winning in Florida by 23,000 votes in addition to more than 500,000 votes nationally in the popular vote. By the way, in the second of the Guardian articles, I neglected to give the proper research credit, which is to Kathy Close, a producer with Oasis TV. We're going to continue with analysis from the brilliant Berkeley researcher Peter Dale Scott of links between the anti-Castro Cuban milieu, links between that milieu and terrorist activities, and elements of the Central Intelligence Agency and the Republican mob that helped to force the halting of the recount and that was instrumental in effecting what the London Observer and the Guardian labeled a right-wing coup in America. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience. These are two unpublished updates to the two articles that I read from Peter Dale Scott inside one of this particular program. These can be apparently accessed at the website http://socrates.berkeley.edu, and that is Peter Dale Scott's website, I assume. This first is dated December 21st of the year 2000. It's called Unpublished Update to Story on Miami Cubans, and it deals with an element of the Miami Cuban community called Vigilio Mambisa, V-I-G-I-L-I-A, capital M-A-M-B-I-S-A, which is linked with the Cuban-American National Foundation of Jorge Mascanosa, and it was in turn instrumental in helping to muster the pressure on the electoral officials in Miami-Dade. Note also the role of Radio Mambi in helping to gather that mob. This update, again, from 12/21/2000, unpublished by Peter Dale Scott, but made available to us by a listener. This reads in part as follows, speaking of the anti-Castro Cuban mob in Florida. They were mostly from a small but tightly disciplined Cuban splinter faction, Vigilio Mambisa, which has been accused of organizing protests for a fee. The group's leader denies the accusation. Vigilio Mambisa participated actively in the Bush electoral campaign, some of its members being paid to call radio stations from Republican phone banks. The CANF, in contrast, remained neutral during the election, preferring to cultivate its political influence with both political parties. All this, however, increases rather than reduces the importance of the connections laid out in my published story. The protest in the building was in accordance with a permit obtained jointly by the leader of Mambisa and the Republican Party. The day after their victory in Miami-Dade, Mambisa followers were bused to Fort Lauderdale in Broward County. After a day of protests there, they took part in the victory banquet to which Governor Bush phoned to express his thanks. In both counties, the Cubans were thrust in front of the TV cameras to create the false illusion that the demonstrations were the spontaneous outbursts of local citizens. Do not forget the role of CANF's Radio Mambi in reinforcing this illusion. The whole procedure, which involved violence in intimidating and obstructing the canvassing board, is now seen as an event planned and orchestrated jointly by Cuban extremists and elements in the Republican Party. And skipping down, Peter Dale Scott in yet another unpublished supplement to the stories that I read earlier. By the way, more information on that particular update can be accessed on the website www.miaminewtimes.com. That's one word, M-I-A-M-I-N-E-W-T-I-M-E-S.com. And in another unpublished supplement to the first two articles that I read inside one of this broadcast, Peter Dale Scott further develops the connections between Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida, and the anti-Castro Cuban milieu, and the milieu of the Contras. I dealt with that in not only RFA 37, but also in the aforementioned For the Record program number 259, titled Beating the Bush in Florida. In this update to the CANF Bush family story, Peter Dale Scott, the brilliant Berkeley researcher, writes as follows. Of Jeb Bush's connections to the Contras and the anti-Castro Cuban milieu, he says, after Jeb's father was elected vice president in 1980, Jeb moved to Florida and worked for Armando Codina, C-O-D-I-N-A, who was a member of the CANF Board of Directors until he resigned in 1992. That's the aforementioned Cuban-American National Foundation of Jorge Mascanosa that we dealt with inside one of this program. Continuing. In this way, Jeb became friendly with a number of Cuban extremists who participated in the CANF project of supporting the Contras. One of these, Miguel Riqueri, fled the country after indictment for massive defrauding of the U.S. government. Another, Leonel Martinez, was eventually convicted of drug trafficking through the period he supported both the Contras and the Jeb Bush political machine. Today, Armando Codina is one of the Florida Republican electors who will vote on December 18th for George W. Bush. That last sentence again, today, Armando Codina is one of the Florida Republican electors who will vote on December 18th for George W. Bush. Another is CANF's treasurer, Feliciano M. Foyo, F-O-Y-O. Foyo is a good friend of Jeb Bush and also of Luis Posada, who in his autobiography names Foyo as one of those CANF members who supported him financially in his terrorist period. By the way, Posada recently arrested in Panama, charged with attempting to murder Fidel Castro. Luis Posada was active in the Contra support effort and also in the Carú faction of the Internacional Fascista that we dealt with in RFA 37 and For the Record Program 259. Continuing. For more on Jeb Bush and Armando Codina, see also the following excerpt from a Jeff Gerst story in the New York Times of April 19, 1992. He then quotes that excerpt at length, and it reads, in 1985, Jeb Bush and Mr. Codina used a $4.6 million loan that a business associate took out for them from Broward Federal Savings and Loan Association in Sunrise, Florida, to buy a Miami office building. The loan went into default, contributing to Broward's subsequent failure. After lengthy negotiations with federal regulators, Mr. Bush and Mr. Codina repaid $505,000 and the federal government assumed the rest of the debt, more than $4 million. In interviews, federal regulators said the settlement was fair and that it was the best they could recover. Late last year, federal regulators sued the officers and directors of Broward, charging that the loan used by Mr. Bush and Mr. Codina cost the savings and loan at least $4.97 million and was representative of the association's negligent lending practices. Among the practices cited was the failure to analyze whether the ultimate borrower, the Bush-Codina partnership, was creditworthy. The suit also said that the loan was closed before it was approved by Broward's Board of Directors. So also links there between the anti-Castro Cuban milieu, the Contra milieu, Jeb Bush, and the savings and loan scandal. Still more on links between, quote, ex-unquote CIA personnel and the rigging of the vote in Florida. Research credit on this also goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the website www.campaignwatch.org. That's C-A-M-P-A-I-G-N-W-A-T-C-H, one word, .org. This is authored by David E. Scheim, S-C-H-E-I-M, and it's titled Absentee Ballot Fraud in Five Florida Counties. And the amount of not only ballot fraud, but also the massive blocking of African-American voters in Florida in actions reminiscent of the Jim Crow days of the Old South is something that's received coverage not only on this broadcast, but elsewhere. I'm not going to go into too much detail here due to the limitations of time. However, this article notes the role of an ex-CIA agent in apparently helping to rig the absentee ballot fraud in Martin County, Florida. David E. Scheim writes, in Seminole County, GOP actions a court ruled illegal, perjured testimony, and unsupervised access to election office files and computers were just part of a Watergate-style operation that is beginning to unravel. In Martin County, ex-CIA agent Charles Kane participated in a scheme to remove GOP absentee ballot requests and fill in voter identification numbers, which a Florida court again ruled illegal. And the footnoted reference there is to the Associated Press from December 7th of the year 2000. So note that an, quote, ex-unquote CIA agent Charles Kane was involved in the apparent rigging of absentee ballots. Note again that the question of a, quote, ex-unquote CIA agent is always one that must be dealt with very carefully. As we just mentioned, the voting in Florida was rife with irregularities and outright illegalities, as well as mob action that's instigated in considerable measure, as we have seen, by some of the anti-Castro Cuban and Bush faction of the CIA milieu that we've dealt with in so many broadcasts over the years. However, one Florida citizen who did not have his right to vote interfered with, but who actually had his right to vote restored by Governor Jeb Bush of Florida, was Charles Colson, the ruthless Nixon White House aide who once wrote that he would walk over his grandmother if necessary to ensure Nixon's re-election. Research credit on the following also goes to a member of the listening audience. This is an article from the St. Petersburg Times of October 10th of the year 2000. It's about Jeb Bush restoring Colson's right to vote. The article is Dateline Tallahassee, Florida, and it reads in part as follows. In the 1970s, Charles Colson made headlines as the loyal aide to President Richard Nixon during the Watergate scandal. Colson once wrote, quote, I would walk over my grandmother if necessary, unquote, to ensure Nixon's re-election. Nixon eventually resigned, and Colson went to federal prison, disgraced. Now, in a quiet way, Colson has been given back some of his dignity by the state of Florida more than a quarter of a century after Watergate. Governor Jeb Bush and three members of the Florida cabinet issued an executive order Monday that restores Colson's civil rights, including his right to vote. Whereas many African-American voters in Florida were inappropriately disqualified as being convicted felons, one certifiably convicted felon, Charles Colson, had his right to vote restored by Jeb Bush. We're going to conclude this broadcast with a reading that I've presented periodically, and I want to ask listeners to project themselves backward in time into the early period of Nazi Germany and to relate subjectively their own reactions to what's going on today to the subjective account of what it was like to live during the rise of Hitler, this presented by a German university professor who was opposed to the Nazis. We're going to be reading from a book, which is the reference to which the title of this broadcast refers. This book is titled, They Thought They Were Free, subtitled The Germans, 1933 to 1945. It was authored by Milton Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R. It was published in 1955 by the University of Chicago. Its ISBN number is 0-226-51190. -1, that for the cloth-bound and paper-bound editions. And this is a chapter entitled, But Then It Was Too Late. And this is, again, the subjective account by an anti-Nazi university professor of what it was like to live during the rise of Hitler. Quote, what happened here was the gradual habituation of the people little by little to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand, or so dangerous that even if the people could understand it, it could not be released because of national security. And their sense of identification with Hitler, their trust in him, made it easier to widen this gap and reassure those who would otherwise have worried about it. This separation of government from people, this widening of the gap took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure or associated with true patriotic allegiance or with real social purposes. And all the crises and reforms, real reforms too, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter. You will understand me when I say that my Middle High German was my life. It was all I cared about. I was a scholar, a specialist. Then suddenly I was plunged into all the new activity as the university was drawn into the new situation. Meetings, conferences, interviews, ceremonies, and above all papers to be filled out, reports, bibliographies, lists, questionnaires. And on top of that were the demands in the community, the things in which one had to, was expected to, unquote, participate, that had not been there or had not been important before. It was all rigmarole, of course, but it consumed all one's energies, coming on top of the work one really wanted to do. You can see how easy it was, then, not to think about fundamental things. One had no time, unquote. Those, I said, are the words of my friend the baker. One had no time to think. There was so much going on, unquote. Your friend the baker was right, said my colleague, again quoting, "The dictatorship, and the whole process of its coming into being was above all, diverting. It provided an excuse not to think for people who did not want to think anyway. I do not speak of your little men, your baker and so on. I speak of my colleagues and myself, learned men, mind you. Most of us did not want to think about fundamental things and never had. There was no need to. Nazism gave us some dreadful fundamental things to think about. We were decent people, and kept us so busy with continuous changes and, quote, crises, unquote, and so fascinated, yes, fascinated, by the machinations of the national enemies, unquote, without and within, that we had no time to think about these dreadful things that were growing little by little all around us. Unconsciously, I suppose, we were grateful. Who wants to think? To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness, acuity, than most of us had ever had occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained, or on occasion, quote, regretted, unquote, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures, unquote, that no patriotic German, unquote, could resent must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. One day, it is over his head. How is this to be avoided among ordinary men, even highly educated ordinary men? Frankly, I do not know. I do not see even now. Many, many times since it all happened, I have pondered that great pair of maxims, Principis obsta and finem respis. Resist the beginnings and consider the end. But one must foresee the end in order to resist or even see the beginnings. One must foresee the end clearly and certainly. And how is this to be done by ordinary men or even by extraordinary men? Things might have changed here before they went as far as they did. They didn't, but they might have. And everyone counts on that might. Your little men, your Nazi friends, were not against National Socialism in principle. Men like me who were are the greater offenders, not because we knew better, that would be too much to say, but because we sensed better. Pastor Niemöller spoke for the thousands and thousands of men like me when he spoke too modestly of himself and said that, when the Nazis attacked the communists, he was a little uneasy, but after all, he was not a communist, and so he did nothing. And then they attacked the socialists, and he was a little uneasier, but still, he was not a socialist, and he did nothing. And then the schools, the press, the Jews, and so on, and he was always uneasier, but still, he did nothing. And then they attacked the church, and he was a churchman, and he did something. But then it was too late, unquote. Yes, I said. You see, my colleague went on, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, Each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for one great, shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join with you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble, unquote. Why not? Well, you are not in the habit of doing it. And it is not just fear of standing alone, that restrains you. It is also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor, and instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside, in the streets, in the general community, everyone, unquote, is happy. One hears no protest, and certainly sees none. You know, in France or Italy, there would be slogans against the government painted on walls and fences. In Germany, outside the great cities, perhaps, there is not even this. In the university community, in your own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom certainly feel as you do. But what do they say? They say, "It's not so bad," or "You're seeing things," or "You're an alarmist." And you are an alarmist. You are saying that this must lead to this, and you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? And how do you know for sure, and begin again, these are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? And how do you know or even surmise the end? On the one hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party, intimidate you. On the other, your colleagues poo-poo you as pessimistic or even neurotic. You are left with your close friends, who are naturally people who have always thought as you have. But your friends are fewer now. Some have drifted off somewhere or submerged themselves in their work. You no longer see as many as you did at meetings or gatherings. Informal groups become smaller. Attendance drops off in little organizations, and the organizations themselves wither. Now, in small gatherings of your oldest friends, you feel that you are talking to yourselves, that you are isolated from the reality of things. This weakens your confidence still further and serves as a further deterrent to what? It is clear all the time that if you are going to do anything, you must make an occasion to do it, and then you are obviously a troublemaker. So you wait and you wait. But the one great shocking occasion, when tens or hundreds or thousands will join with you, never comes. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and smallest, thousands, yes, millions, would have been sufficiently shocked if, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come immediately after the "German firm" stickers on the windows of non-Jewish shops in 33. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. Step C is not so much worse than Step B, and if you did not make a stand at Step B, why should you at Step C? And so on, to Step D. And one day, too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy, and some minor incident, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, "Juice wine," collapses it all at once, and you see that everything has changed and changed completely under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were born in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring, the houses, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays, but the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear, and the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Now you live in a system which rules without responsibility even to God. The system itself could not have intended this in the beginning, but in order to sustain itself, it was compelled to go all the way. You have gone almost all the way yourself now. Life is a continuing process, a flow, not a succession of acts and events at all. It has flowed to a new level. carrying you with it without any effort on your part. On this new level you live, you have been living more comfortably every day with new morals, new principles. You have accepted things you would not have accepted 5 years ago, a year ago, things that your father, even in Germany, could not have imagined. Suddenly, it all comes down, all at once. You see what you are, what you have done, or, more accurately, what you haven't done. For that was all that was required of most of us, that we do nothing. And I'm going to conclude the broadcast the way I began it. Reading now from the San Jose Mercury News from January 6th of the year 2001, article by Stephen Thoma, THOMMAA, Mercury News, Washington Bureau, Dateline, Washington, headlined, Bush positions himself as chairman of the board, skipping down. Bush's plan for governing casts him as a sort of corporate board chairman who will set broad goals and trust others to work out the details. And then we're going to read from Benito Mussolini's volume, The Corporate State, published in 1938 in English by Velecki Publishers. Copyright 1938. Velecki was in Florence. V-A-L-L-E-C-H-I is how it's spelled. This from a speech by Mussolini, given on November 13th of 1933, actually given the next day, November 14th. It's titled On the Corporate State, and it reads in part, Resolution drafted by the head of the Italian government and read by him on November 13, 1933, before the Assembly of the National Council of Corporations on the eve of his important speech. The National Council of Corporations defines corporations as the instruments which, under the aegis of the state, carries out the complete organic and totalitarian regulation of production with a view to the expansion of the wealth, political power, and well-being of the Italian people. The National Council of Corporations declares that the number of corporations to be formed for the main branches of production should, on principle, be adequate to meet the real needs of national economy. The National Council of Corporations establishes that the general staff of each corporation shall include representatives of state administration, of the fascist party, of capital, of labor, and of experts. The National Council of Corporations assigns to the corporations as their specific tasks conciliation, consultation compulsory on problems of major importance, and the promulgation through the National Council of Corporations of laws regulating the economic activities of the country. The National Council of Corporations leaves to the Grand Council of Fascism the decision on the further developments of a constitutional and political order which should result from the effective formation and practical working of the corporations. I've made reference to other broadcasts. Those broadcasts, all of them are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They can be reached by regular mail at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California. That's capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. You can visit the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. There are descriptions and lists of all of the programs available on that website. You can listen to my weekly radio show on KFJC-FM at kfjc.org at 7 to 10 p.m. Sunday and 6 to 7 p.m. Thursday Pacific Time. And you can also visit the Real Audio archives of the For the Record broadcast now being compiled by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. You can access those on WFMU's website at wfmu.org/Dave Emory, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. And you can email me at demory@kfjc.org. That concludes For the Record program number 268. Americans Thought They Were Free. This is being recorded on January 7th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.